Okay. So here we are for another installment of the FLT podcast. Thank you for joining us. Today we are joined by Valtteri Raakallio. We've had, I hope I pronounced that correctly. We've had a number of guests on so far, but they've all tended to have like a commercial or a business background. And what we wanted to start to do was to sort of explore different fields. And in those fields, we wanted to see what were the similarities or the differences that we could find with Finnish leadership. When we were looking for young leaders or modern leaders in the artistic world, your name was pretty much top of the pile as one of the rising stars. And so we were very eager to have you come and sit in the seat. Welcome. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great. As always, we prepared a little bit of an introduction. Annalie, would you do the honors?
Sure, absolutely. There's a little bit of education here about how the funding system of art in Finland in general works, because some of our listeners are abroad. So Valtteri, you are a prominent Finnish dancer, as Mark said, a choreographer, a teacher, and an artistic director. You are also an entrepreneur leading Raakallio Corporation, which was established in 2013 and is an independent dance company based in Helsinki. Independent art companies have a tough time in Finland. The central government subsidies are mostly earmarked to well-established art institutions, leaving the independent art companies to compete of the lesser funding given by the arts promotion center called Taike. You have extensively talked about this, saying it's foolish that Raakallio Corporation's performances are sold out, but we need to turn people away only because we cannot afford additional rental payments of the required spaces. Finland has lost a lot of artists due to this. As a dancer, you have worked with major international and Finnish choreographers and directors in almost 100 productions in 40 countries. Your own productions reach from immersive or site-specific works and stage work to film projects. Currently, you are working together with Thomas Freundlich on a documentary of your mentor, Tommy Kitti, with whom you had a master-apprentice relationship for 9 years. You have been nominated to lead Helsinki Dance Company at Helsinki City Theatre starting in August. You yourself worked as a dancer at HDC in 2006-2013 and called it at that time a very hierarchical workplace. Your works take a stance on societal issues such as school bullying or mental health, which you yourself have experiences about and have openly talked about them. In your work, you are also keen on exploring the effects of different forms of authority and power. You have said, "I don't believe that any artist can function if they feel that they are subdued by someone utilizing superior power over them." Is this a good characterization of you, Valtteri? Well, and how would you describe your personal coping mechanisms in when you feel overpowered or subdued?
Oh wow, yeah. Well, it's a how do you say, it's a good official characterization for sure. It's a bio. Maybe for my coping mechanisms, one of the biggest like revelations for myself in the past few years have been understanding that I could probably describe myself as a workaholic. So a lot of the things that I do are, how do you say, like compulsive behavior. The reason of working is maybe not always so, I don't know, well-intended. It's more of a, there's a hellhound on my trail kind of a feeling. But the coping mechanisms for sure are social relationships and sleeping and sports. That's kind of the gist of it. I just last night was, I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu as a hobby, and last night I was in the tight embrace of my friends again. and there's a lot of very interesting things happening, like mentally when you do something like that, which is kind of like the body thinks it's dangerous that somebody's trying to strangle you to death, but it's actually very safe and it's close to people, like being physically close to people who you enjoy and like and trust. And there's a lot of things happening when you're actually in physical closeness with somebody that we maybe don't even understand.
Do you have bad coping mechanisms? Something that you don't recommend to anybody?
All kind of addictive behavior. I think it's the same kind of, it goes with the same territory of this mechanics of working too much.
Yeah.
That you kind of like get this rush when you're thinking or working, like inside of your brain, you can hype yourself up and actually work immense amounts of like just put in a lot of hours per week, and it gives you a kick. But I mean that kick somehow brain chemically is you need to pay the taxes at some point, and that's not a pretty sight.
Thanks for sharing.
And I think BJJ, like a lot of sports, it's a kind of thinking, but it's not thinking, right? So you're always active and alert and responsive, but you're not reflective, right? It's not you don't really involve yourself in cognition that much. You have perhaps a strategy to outmaneuver your opponent, but there's no like.
Yeah, it's you're touching something very very deep now, because I understand what you're saying. I would maybe go towards saying that it doesn't involve like a language based cognition, but the way that we function in our body, and like if coordination is the rhythmic knowledge of how to coordinate, how to like arrange your body, it is definitely a way of thinking, and it is definitely a way of cognition. And when you're watching a basketball player or a football player on a soccer pitch, there's a lot of cognition happening, even though it's probably not language based. Mm. Like when Messi knows exactly where to be in the pitch before those two passes that arrive to him, he knows that in advance, and it doesn't have anything to do with
he's not thinking about it.
He's not or he's yeah. like bodily aware of the situation, and this is it's maybe I'm just trying to oppose or be a little bit critical about the way that we think about thinking, that thinking is not just something that is language based, like us talking to ourselves. It's also this kind of
feeling
and the way that we inhabit our body, and the way that our bodies are in relations to other people's bodies in the same space. This is a way of thinking, because you obviously can see when somebody's really good and really, really skilled in that. You see that somebody could be magically good in that. So there is some kind of skill, something is happening in their brain, even, and they can develop that, even though it's outside of the grasp of language.
Can I ask at this stage? So actually in academia, there's quite a famous saying that that goes like this: how do I know what I think before I see what I say? So but what you're saying is that we don't need to express anything in language to know what we think. Is that...
Well, I think that, yeah, maybe thinking is a spectrum, like electromagnetic radiation, that there's light and there's gamma rays and x-ray, and language-based thinking is one part of the spectrum. But there are like other parts, like outside of the like language-based or analytical thinking, maybe is a good word. So there's other thinking than analytical thinking. And how do you say those leak or are in interaction with the other, like the borders of the spectrum are not clear.
Well, and if you think about it through the lens of a coping mechanism, I think what you basically just said was, when I feel overloaded cognitively or cerebrally or intellectually, I then channel a thinking through my body.
I
seek out the, let's say, physical thinking to kind of redress the balance.
Which
I think is, that's kind of, this is like 2 minutes in.
No, because it's a huge thing in our society, because we are more and more coming like vessels for our brains, which are interconnected to other people through application or through machines, and this is something that, I mean, it's all and good, and productivity will rise, and sure, fantastic, we're getting closer and closer of solving a lot of humanity's problems. But at the same time, we are kind of like, I don't know, are we losing something in this way to communicate, to touch, and to understand how people are? And that is something that is very much at least soothing, and for a child. It's something that is really important in building up a child's sense of self and boundaries, and the way that a child can communicate about his feelings, which will come out or be expressed physically, because he doesn't have the language capacity yet to do the complicated work of transforming all those feelings and physical sensations to something which could be like discussed and communicated through words. But
it's not just children. So I know, I mean, we know teams. If you want to build trust in teams, there is a nascent sensing that we have of each other, which doesn't always get articulated until we actually know each other relatively well. And we know that when we have teams that are working, for example, virtually or in a disconnected environment, it's a lot harder for them to reach a common understanding.
Just.
It's a lot harder for them to pitch together towards a common goal.
Yeah.
And it's a lot harder for them to start trusting themselves in that implicit way. I think there's a lot of already evidence post-COVID now about where teams now need more support and how team members are feeling more and more isolated.
Yeah.
So I think there is a... But yeah, we went really deep, really fast.
There's a lot in there.
There's a lot to unpack there. Yeah.
What comes to my mind is when you say that you start reacting through your body when you work hard, and it's visible through, you know, even though you get a lot of done, but it's also addictive, and it's, and I think a lot of leaders don't recognize that, even though they try to, you know, the way they try to appear is calmness and intellectual language usage and spoken words, but their body tells something else. Tells that I'm absolutely, you know, not there. I'm you know, at the verge of burning out or dropping down or whatever.
I think that's most, in my experience, it's most visible in listening, right? So you can, like, people can hear what they can hear, and if you can't hear, if there's something said between the lines or something you need to pick up emotionally, if you can't hear it, it's a strange paradox because it's beyond your range. But if you're tired, your range is smaller.
Exactly, yeah.
Right, and shorter. And I think, a lot of leaders do tend to bury themselves in their work, probably to the detriment of the team. It kind of creates a reinforcing cycle where they can't ask for help and a bunch of other issues.
All right. So, Valtteri, let us go to our kind of one of the foundational questions of this podcast. So how would you define or describe your leadership philosophy?
I think that I'm a coaching leader in that sense, that the kind of like the only asset that we have are the people that we're working with, because like financially we're so under-resourced that like putting 10 cents to this or that is not the way to think about leadership. It's about trying to cultivate people and their talents. Maybe from if I step back, there's like two big questions in when leading an arts project. It's like, what are we doing and who are we doing it with? Mm. And kind of like the third thing, that how do we do it, is not that important if you get the two first questions right. If you screw up with one of the first questions, if you don't build the right team for the project, or if you don't have a good idea of the artistic direction where you're going, then you're going to need a lot of thinking in how we are like managing the situation or leading the situation. But if you have the right people, the right kind of people who are like willing to bring a lot of themselves into the situation, like really give their input to the situation, and the group is diverse enough, but still they can find the common grounds of how to work, and they know the direction where the process is trying to go, then you don't really have to do that much. Like, honestly, then the magic with artists really happen. Then you're just like giving them space and making sure that they take some breaks, and it's really the best processes are very like organic and self-driving, and people are feeding out of each other. It's beautiful, but if two of these basic principles is a little bit off, then you need to look at the people or support the people more as individuals, and there will be more conflict, and there will be more like emotional baggage in the situation that you as a leader are kind of like responsible of handling in a way that people feel validated and feel that their points of view and their feelings get noticed and understood, but still that the group doesn't shift its way according to the biggest drama, queen or king, kind of like. And then that's a very huge thing of how to lead an arts or a creative process, because people are so emotionally so involved in the thing. They are not in it for the salary or the perks. They are just in it because they want to do it, and they really want to do it, and they want to succeed in it, and they want the thing to or the project to succeed. And it's kind of like finding a balance with different personalities of how much they're in it to succeed from themselves, and how can you divert that energy for the benefit of the project. So it's very like HR leading in that sense.
Can I still ask, looking at these different dimensions of what you just talked about, so how do you actually create this common understanding as a leader in such a diverse group?
Well, what makes it easy or what gives it a good chance of succeeding is exactly because we're working so much physically in contact with each other, and the body doesn't lie in that sense. So you understand when people are dancing well together, when they can communicate physically well without thinking or explaining, or when it works physically, it will work like that. So you see if there's friction, and then kind of like the outside, the director's job is to see those things of friction and then have tools to like different kind of physical tasks or different kind of mental images to try to work past those frictions for the two dancers or five dancers or 12 dancers to find a common, it is kind of like a common physicality to work with. If you get that right, then like managing the breaks or the holidays or the salaries or it's just like peanut, then it's just like Excel. Oh, we need to have we need to do, then it's just like management. Not to say that that's easy, but then it's quite straightforward what you need to do. Mm. But if there's the frictions between the people and the artistry or the passions of the people, how to like lubricate those, that they support each other and complement each other, that's the thing. But the thing with dance and being in the same room with people is that you actually quite soon get a sense that are those people working well together? And we recruit people very slowly. I've been working with the same dancers for pretty much from the start. We take in maybe one person every other year. Now, last year we took in three, but we had quite an intensive auditioning process, and I do it with the dancers. So there was two dancers and me working together for a day with a group of people. And then we found three really good people. And for the first time, I also hired somebody who was like really young as an artist in her 20s, because usually I've been working with people my age who already have a very like 15 or 20 years of experience of professional work. And I'm super happy with the young person that we were able to bring in. And she has been really bringing in good stuff and like different perspectives to the group, because this kind of we have been so similarly aged that it's been getting a little bit narrow, maybe the spectrum of just thinking and feeling. And now it's super nice to have somebody who's half the age of mostly our crew. So
you're young.
Yeah, exactly. Now I'm 42.
Just one more. What interests me is this. So who decides that there's this chemistry or there's no chemistry? Is it your decision or is it a joint decision?
It's a joint decision. And we kind of like know the chemistry already with the group that we have been working for, because we've been doing many, many, many projects. And this chemistry, of course, somebody can be going through a divorce or somebody's parent died, and these things really, really affect the work, because you can't do this kind of thing and leave your personal life outside of the door. It just does not work like that. So kind of like the artistic processes need to be robust or resilient enough that it can take like external blows like that, and that is just about the people really need to trust each other, and they need to have the right to come to the workplace, even though we're working on a project for maybe 3 months, so it's very short, like sprint in a way, mm-hmm. that something has happened. I'm actually not being, I won't be able to perform at that level that I, you kind of like know that I, and people have to have the right to come in and say that. Mm-hmm. And then the group needs to figure out, okay, until now I have been, I've had the privilege to be able to work with a group of people who really have been so generous towards each other that this has actually been the case. But that's why I've also been so hesitant to hire new people, because every time you bring somebody new, the whole
the group changes. The dynamics change.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's yeah.
Is there a connection between emotional disconnection and physical accidents?
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't thought of it like that, but for I mean, yeah, I could imagine that that's true. But I mean, you sense it very quickly if your partner or somebody is not there, and then it becomes dangerous. But I don't know, is it like a kind of like a cognitive relapse, or it's kind of like, what words do you give them? Yeah. This emotional. But of course, if somebody is having some kind of crisis in life, there are situations when you just have to say that you need to go home and come back next Monday and let's see how it is, because this is not beneficial, and you need to be able to do that, because in work like this, it's not, well, in some sense it's enough that you just come there in the right time and in the right place, but you have to come there in this like mental space of being ready, being available for the thing that's going to happen. If you're not available, like mentally, you don't have any, you can't come, you just need to go home, because you can't just like punch in the hours. That it's not how this works.
Yeah, I had a couple of thoughts from before. So you mentioned that the body doesn't lie, which I think is good confirmation that Shakira was right.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's good. And I think the second thing that occurs to me is that I think what you describe, at least in the sort of commercial world, it sounds a lot like a lot of theories come around the term flow state. So you try to get into a place where you can actually work with each other seamlessly.
Yeah.
The challenge for that, which I think is a little bit related to your two principles, can be that the goal or the task isn't challenging enough for the group, right? So if you have to kind of select the group and get them into a state in relation to the goal they're trying to achieve, how do you help the group develop and improve? How do they push themselves forward? Because any development is a natural stress there, right?
Yeah, so, yeah. That's a good question. I would maybe answer it from a with a twist. Because kind of like in our work, the thing is that the dancers that I've been working with, the dancers are so good that they are very good in getting into this flow state. That's kind of like their a big thing in their professional toolkit, that they can start tripping. We usually call it tripping, because and the kind of like when I'm searching for a certain kind of like movement material to use in a performance, I'm kind of like searching for something that it's almost like close to pattern recognition, or I know when I see it, but I can't explain it beforehand. So it's kind of like I recognize when it happens, and we're videotaping everything, like all the rehearsals, and so then we can actually go back to it from a recording. But I know when I see it, but I'm just like coming up with tasks and ideas of what the dancers will try, and then 95% of it, that's it, okay, let's continue with this. And the problem with this flow state is that the dancers are so good in going to this, well, tripping, as we say, going to this flow state, it's so enjoyable, but the flow state doesn't equal the material that we are searching for. The flow state is a nice place for them to be, because it feels amazing and wow, and they're always doing like great stuff, but it's not usually the stuff that we're actually looking for.
Yeah.
So they're like professionals in going to this like self, how do you say, hypnotizing themselves to this thing that they can go for on, and it makes sense, and it does make sense, and it's good stuff. But usually we just need 5% of it, and then the job of the director is to like be able to pinpoint out what is the 5% and then try to talk about what was special in this 5% so the dancers can try to hypnotize themselves
to get
towards that. And that's kind of like what directing is recognizing that something happens, which is something that we're actually, this is something that is a part of what we need, even though it's not clear what we're going towards yet, kind of like, but recognizing those small flashes and being able to like articulate and make them visible for everybody in the room so they can like reorientate their own focus and artistry to try to like navigate their ships more toward that. And then, okay, and this is even better. And this is, mm-hmm. and that's the kind of refinement process that's going on in the weeks in the dance studio, kind of like.
Mm.
Mm. What's the timeline of a production?
Usually with me, it's like 2 years or 1.5 years from the initial idea until the premiere. And that has like a pretty much a 1 year. I have kind of like three gates that the ideas go through. First one, it's just that there's an idea and then I'm thinking about it and maybe reading something or like trying to understand what it is that I'm interested in. And I don't know, 75% of ideas die in this, that actually it there's something that you get excited about and then you're working on it for some weeks or months and half a year and then it kind of like fades away and it just doesn't interest you or me enough that I keep working on it. Mm. And I can have many ideas like this in the kind of like pipeline of ideas. Yeah. And then they go into pre-production. And if they go into pre-production, which is kind of like the first gate, then that's kind of a thing that then we start to use money on it. So okay. First it's just like my mental thing. So then we can hire a designer to come do some sketches or work with somebody or go somewhere and see some, or then it's kind of like this pre-production thing. And if, I don't know, 20 or 25% of ideas went through the idea phase to pre-production, then this 25% in pre-production, 20% die there, mm-hmm. that actually this is not interesting enough or it's going to be too expensive or we mm-hmm. don't know how to solve these problems, or you kind of like try to bring in some facts so that you could understand how could this actually become a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's about resources and yeah. And then this 5% of the ideas go into maybe production or 3% go into actual production, and then it's then that's maybe, I don't know, 16 months, 12, mm-hmm. a year, 1.5 years of like building the team. You mm-hmm. usually you need to have the team 1 year or 1.5 years, know which dancers and who's the light designer and mm-hmm. and then I usually like to work so that we have a 1-2 week period somewhere with the dancers. And then we have 3 months off or 2 months off. Everybody's doing different things. And I can just think like what happened in the first 2 or 3 weeks. And then we have maybe 6 or 8 weeks as a chunk. But I really need this break with after the first tryouts to like go back to my drawing board and like find a new route
okay.
for the thing. So it's very like on and off.
Are you trying to better understand Finnish leaders? You're in the right place. You're listening to the FLT podcast.
So how do you evaluate your projects? So what's the, I mean, based on what you would say that something was a success, something was not a great success?
Yeah, we have many, many different things. I mean, let's talk about artistic quality as a last thing, because that's very complicated. But we survey the staff that everybody whose tax card we have for a project gets a survey afterwards about työhyvinvointi, like
well-being
in the project. And it has some very like factual questions. Or the only thing that is mandatory is like from 1 to 5, how did you find your well-being? And then there's a lot of like more specific questions, and this is kind of like actually a very important indicator for us, which is very, yeah, we actually get a lot of data from that. Of course, if there's a problem or something happens, you see that in the data, but also if the piece didn't artistically go far enough or be good enough, that's also, it's very visible in the data because mm-hmm. everybody is so emotionally invested in the end, in the mission, that if I fail kind of like the group of making a good, making the piece as good as everybody knew that it could be, that is very visible in the, how people felt about their well-being.
Oh my goodness, yeah, that could be a corporation way of working. I mean, measuring well-being and you know, the success, comparing it to the success of the project.
Yeah.
Engineers know, just from previous commercial life in surveys, engineers know the rough quality or the effectiveness of the features they develop.
Just.
And they know before customers see it. So they have the same basic frame of references and they have the last set of technology.
Just.
So I think it is, we don't think about it as Huvinvointi or as well-being.
Yeah.
But if you love your job, if you love, if you're passionate about the thing that you create,
exactly,
then you'll see it.
Exactly. Yeah. Because we get like nuts and bolts information that, okay, the communication with the timetables was a bit crappy in this project. And that's, of course, a good thing to get feedback from. But you really get this, how people felt about the project and their, how well they could perform in the project. This is the actual thing that you can see from that. Well, and then there's, of course, like this kind of budget thing that we know that we were trying to get this much of ticket revenue and hoping to produce it with this, like, very, very simple. And then there's this, like, artistic quality, which, of course, there's the feedback from audience and media, which is one part of it, but that's, like, 30% of it, and 60% of it is like, your inner idea of how it went. And it's really so much stronger that when you understand that you kind of, like, you kind of like, you really like were able to do what you, the best job that you think that you can do with something. It doesn't matter what, if you get a bad review, it's he or she didn't get it. But if you feel yourself that, boom, this is exactly what was supposed to be, it's the best. And this is something that is very much shared in the group, in the work group. So this kind of, and you kind of like know this week before the premiere that there's this, it starts to feel special. It's almost like a religious, that it starts to feel like a, it's like condensing meanings into it. It becomes something that you don't kind of like understand, or nobody owns it in a way. It's not my thing. It's not the dance. It's somehow the thing is in between us. And then when that hits the audience, it's magic. That's kind of like, and every time it doesn't happen, but when it starts to happen and it starts to become this own actual, I don't know, entity of ideas and feelings, and it's, yeah.
So between two kind of hypothetical cases, one would be, you know, it's a perfect artistically piece that you develop, everybody's happy in your group, and then terrible reviews, and nobody comes to see the show, versus, you know, you're not satisfied fully with the artistic qualities of what you've done, but it's a great success, amazing reviews. Which one would you go for?
Definitely the thing that we think it's good. And I had very, like, I can get very depressed after a project that I feel that I didn't succeed in, even though it could get a very good, like, public feedback. And that's kind of like a part of my problem, that the inner idea of what just happened is so strong that it doesn't matter what somebody from the outside is saying. And usually, because it's also in my ethos of leadership, I give a lot of responsibility for the people, but I'm the one who's responsible in the end. And if I know that, even though we had good ideas and we made the ideas so that our resources were enough, and if I did, that's my fault, because I know that I have the best people working for me, and I know that they are super motivated to do the best possible job. And then it's just on me. And if I don't feel that I was able to go far enough or find the actual thing that we were looking for, it doesn't matter that if somebody said that it was really nice, and I know when I have kind of like failed the situation. and then I have failed the situation, and that's...
But what if you are personally, you think it was not perfect, but everyone in your group actually is satisfied? Would that be...
Yeah, and that, I mean, if it's a... That's kind of like this middle ground, that, and that's usually a thing that we have been able to make the process so that people feel meaning in work and felt that they have been able to put things in that actually made the piece better, and maybe we didn't quite get there. And I mean, of course, this is not a, how do you say, digital one and a zero thing.
Binary,
exactly. Yeah. This is also a spectrum, but usually the, because it's a magic circle, it's a cult. That's you. The working group is a cult for that moment that you're creating the thing. You have your kind of like, the whole thing of an artistic process is that you're trying to create a way of, a prototypical way of thinking or being in the world, and that is the piece of art. And you're trying to do that with those people that you're working with, this prototypical way of seeing the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if the people in the working group feel that, God damn it, this was actually a super interesting and cool way of being in the world, that's plenty. And if the critic doesn't see it the same way, it's kind of like her loss.
Yeah.
But
I think, so at least now, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu makes complete sense to me.
Yeah.
So because I mean, so reflecting on kind of like my own career earlier on, I had one or two successes with a small team. And the feeling of bringing a project to fruition and then showing leaders and other parts of the company something they hadn't seen before,
yeah,
was like, difficult. It's difficult to articulate, yeah, what it felt like, but it was very good.
Yeah.
And for years after that, I tried to replicate it,
yeah,
doing similar types of project with similar types of people, but I could never get the right result in the end. And I buried myself in sports because,
yeah,
sports is physically demanding and painful, and I don't have to think.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was one of the very few places, yeah, where I found as like a kind of safe haven away from this churn. And I mean, after a lot of work on myself, I figured out what I was doing and what I was good at and what I wasn't good at. But that process took me a long time.
Yeah.
Do you, when you, I guess, when you try to analyze in the longer scheme of your kind of career,
yeah,
are you comfortable with missing the mark? Do you get used to it?
No. And that's kind of like the reasons why I'm changing jobs now. Because because I've been creating pieces of art so too many pieces of art, like too fast in these 10 years. So I really feel that I have, how do you say, depleted my creativity in that,
yeah,
sense. So now kind of like the role that I'm taking in the City Theatre is more a leadership role, not a... I can create if I want, but I really don't want to create now for the next few years. I want to replenish somehow my, and just like be a leader and try to help other people and other productions thrive. And so, yeah, and I really love that part of the job as well. And that doesn't bring me this kind of mental pain that missing the mark in the actual artistic work brings, and I need longer therapy to yeah, find coping mechanisms for.
I was really reaching for hope there.
Yeah. No, but yeah, but it is hard because kind of like that is the point of, if you're actually creating art, you are making, you are trying to create something, and that is supposed to be difficult, and it's supposed to be kind of like real for you, but outside of your understanding, you're trying to like go out and. If you fail, and that it's supposed to hurt,
yeah,
it is as it is, and I've been able to build this position that, well, yeah, for the first 7 years we were really struggling with the company financially.
Mm.
Now for the last 3 or 4 years, financially I've been in a situation that I've been able to do what I want, and of course we have to scale it to our resources, but that's not a problem. We have had so much resources for the last 3 years that I've been able to creatively work in that scale that was possible.
Mm-hmm.
And if you feel that you get like freedom to do what you want and you fail, it is supposed to hurt.
Yeah.
It is,
but I think the only thing I would say to that though is, I mean, I'm sure while you kind of feel that, and there is a specific exposure in art,
yeah,
that feeling it's the same in any creative process, whether it's in engineering or product or customer or service related industries. I know lots of leaders that have had not as profound, I think, the experience, but certainly very similar. And I could relate to that.
Everything that you are emotionally involved in and all that, you shouldn't do things that you are not emotionally involved in, is my point of view in life.
Yeah.
And if you fail, it's supposed to hurt, and you're supposed to thrive for better, to like expand and be good. And if you fail, it hurts.
It hurts. Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm interested in what happens after a production with that production, that piece of art. If somebody would like, let's say in France or somewhere else in the world, pick that up.
Yeah.
Do you have the IPR? Do you give that piece of art to somebody else? Or, you know, we know the Swan Lakes, et cetera. Somebody owns the movements, their duets, the way they are done.
Yeah.
Is that the same with you, or how does it work?
It's kind of like the same. I mean, or there's like two strategies that we are using right now. One that we have been using much more is that if somebody's interested in it, like a festival, we come and perform it there. But right now, with this one performance that was dealing with school bullying, and it's kind of like a thing that we do with young high school students, this is now something that we're thinking of maybe licensing, because we don't want to travel with a group of students. And this kind of licensing thinking is getting more also important now when people don't want to travel so much, because our field used to be before COVID and still is, there's a lot of traveling to do one gig somewhere, and it kind of like doesn't make any sense. It's nice to travel and see places, but I did that for a long time, and with a family and with the burning globe, it really doesn't make sense. If you go there, it's good to work there and get involved with the local art scene and really have an exchange, but just to fly somewhere and show once your piece in a festival and fly back, it's kind of like, what's actually the cultural value that we're getting from with the cons that are definitely there? So so this kind of licensing the idea and building it on another group is something that's happening more and more in our field right now.
And you own the IPR, so
and our way of doing contracts with our designers and is such that we can sell also the licensing thing, and there's a system of paying people for those like copyrights or
What about space? You have taken people or the audiences to different spaces, and you have moved the audience along with your performances.
Yes.
What kind of a role does the space play?
This is a beautiful circle back to the beginning of the discussion, because as we were talking, I feel strongly that we have this spectrum of thinking or cognition, that this, how do we understand the environment that we are the environment that we are a part of, is it people or the surrounding place? This is all something that is not the boundary between us and the place or us and the people that we are interacting. It is not clear. We are like leaking to each other, like biologically we are spreading germs and senses and smelling each other, and it's exactly the same thing with a place, that a place has its own, or we interpret a place having its own characters, and we as artists, we can manipulate those characters of a place so that we can, like what our architecture is about, we can evoke different kind of feelings or ways of being in space in the audience members. And kind of like if a theater is this kind of laboratory setting for a piece of art, that it's this, there's a routine or a convention of how do you use the theater machine, kind of like how the audience comes there and they sit down and then something is presented to them. That's beautiful. It's a fantastic medium. But let's say that in another religion, when people are standing instead of like sitting as a Lutheran people in the bench, or in a mass when people are standing up for certain things or sitting down or Orthodoxes who are walking around the church, somebody actually has been thinking about this a lot, that it is the way that we are physically interacting with the space, with the people around us, changes the way that we, or if you're in a rock concert and you're standing and like moving slowly with other people, or if you're in the music, house of music, listening to philharmonics, sitting down more in this, and it has exactly to do with this spectrum of thinking and cognition, that there are some ways of, some spectrums of the cognition which kind of like work better, have a better space to work if you silence your body, you sit down or you lie down, and if you're standing or moving or following a performer there or going to another room and seeing something else, you discover the room at the same time as you're seeing something happening there. It's just another way of approaching the sensory system. So
yeah,
we have been interested in playing with that and using that kind of the whole experience of the performance situation as the playground. So
yeah, really interesting.
And it has been cheaper.
Also that. And for those who are just listening to this, you're missing a huge piece because Walter is constantly speaking with his arms and face and expressions.
In our fantastic setting, which is confusing. But
it's good.
Well,
it's good.
When you're an Espo, you understand the importance of place, right?
Yeah.
Subtle joke.
Although actually, I mean, that does bring us on to something we haven't yet touched, which is Finland and Finnishness. What are your general experiences of leadership in Finland? Have you had good bosses? Have you had bad bosses?
I think I have had both bosses, like good and bad, and that has been very instrumentally important for myself finding my own ways of like leading, and especially the ideals of leading, which I'm like constantly thriving for. And I think strongly that in the cultural field, the generation is changing. And it's very like when I started working in the 99-2000, like then professionally, it was like the Finnish art scene was still dominated by the like later generation of arts leaders who are a lot more.
We can bleep this.
Yeah. No, but it was just more like authority based and not communicating in that sense. And the, and there were also like really good leaders who were very well read and civilized and really good things. So it's not a dichotomy in that sense, but this amount of communication and this kind of like, well, the hierarchy of the structure is really in a huge shift. And of course, the whole Me Too movement started in the cultural field. And there's a lot of this really dark undercurrents that really have been plaguing the whole field for decades and decades, which has now been like brought to the surface and are slowly being actually dealt with also in the houses and in the way that the leadership works, and it is a slow process and it is not done yet, but now the mud is visible and it's like possible to try to find processes and ways of actually trying to make the whole field more sustainable, like emotionally, because it's a hugely, because everybody is so emotionally involved, it's a really dangerous work environment for any kind of misuse of power. You can really destroy people, and we have all seen it happen, like in this field. So that's the biggest difference, that those things are now kind of like out in the open, and there's a lot of people and organizations who are actually working hard to find more sustainable ways. And we have a lot of really good young leaders who are showing with, like leading with example, that you can actually do very good art in a very different kind of mental setting. So this is actually a paradigm shift. What has happened in the last 25 years in my work life.
And how did you come to this? What kind of, based on what kind of experiences? To your kind of philosophy that this is not about hierarchies, really. You can manage differently.
Well, I was also involved in projects that suffered under really bad leadership, and I've seen quite close some people like leave the whole industry because of bad leadership. And when I say leave the industry, I mean like get destroyed as people and work lose their ability to work. Mm-hmm. And that just because nobody gets rich in this business, people are really, really fighting to survive, even though when they're working. And if their like mental health gets destroyed, those fates, just like human fates, are actually quite brutal, even in Finland, where we still have a kind of like a welfare system and we have support networks, but people have so little to start with that if they kind of like get run over by abuse of power, that it is brutal. And I was involved in projects where this happens, and it is quite something.
I'd imagine it's almost impossible to. I mean, we talked earlier about the positive side and achieving the flow state, yeah. And finding if there is the shadow or the memory or the impression of that kind of abuse of power dynamics, then I'd imagine it's very difficult to make good art, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it's impossible. Of course, like we can look at the art what happened in the Soviet Union. Yeah. And there was a lot of good art coming, but I mean,
a lot of mustaches.
Yeah, but what was the price? Kind of like that. Sure, you can squeeze people through a horrible filter, and yes, there will be some diamonds afterwards. But I mean, what? There is no point. That is not the only way or the best way. That's the least. That's the worst way of like running a society or producing art is to hurt people, and this is something that it really has changed in the philosophy of a lot of young people. But I mean, this idea of safe, like you have to have this kind of basic feeling of being safe to be able to have courage. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you really think that somebody is out to destroy you, of course there are some special people who can still be that, but I mean, most of us actually need to feel safe, and if we feel safe and secure, we can actually perform cool stuff. We can really we can do good stuff if we know that if we fail, it won't destroy us, and especially it won't destroy us in that small magic circle that is trying to create a new way of looking at the world. You need to have that safety net there. And then if the critic says that this was crap, yeah, it hurts. I mean, sure. Mm. But if you have the security of your own magic circle, you are quite invincible. And the job of the leader is to build that security of that magic circle, like around the project, so that people can be courageous and do crazy stuff and try and
So you talked about the fact that if something goes not ideally in the production, you tend to blame yourself. Is that your way to kind of take pressure away from the artist?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I like to talk a lot with people and I get input and people try to influence them, and they can influence like to some degree the big picture. But it is clear that I am the captain of the ship, and that is clear. So if the ship gets lost at sea and everybody dies, it is my responsibility, and that is kind of like that's my job in a way.
So what would be your dream production? Topic, place, anything? Something that you would like to do that will be
That's a good idea. There's some productions that I have kind of like planned quite far, and then for reasons not of my own have been cancelled. So there's this mine, like a mine that you dig in Finland. I think it's the deepest mine in Europe, and we were planning to do a performance there. that got cancelled because there was a very big environmental problem in another mine, and then all the mines didn't want any attention to their publicity. So they cancelled that, and I was really sorry because I had a very good idea there, but I won't tell what it is because I will do it.
We'll get there.
Because the mine is closing now, that mine is depleted, and the yeah. mining company won't be operating there, so maybe
they'll be in space. I think what Alexa is pitching for is Finnish leadership, the show, right?
Exactly. We can do the second episode in the mine. With
exactly.
You.
Yeah, next time. Yeah. Okay, Valtteri, this was like inspiring. So, we covered an incredible amount of ground. I think what sort of sticks to me, I sort of feel bad calling it the flow state because it's not, not sure that it's exactly accurate for what you want, but...
I understand completely what you're saying, and it is right. I mean, it's just that people who are really, like professional artists are professionals in going to that state.
I think what you meant, the way you said it was, you know, you have to create a vision and then you have to help people trip.
Yeah.
Those tripping people need to see the value of the vision.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fantastic summary or articulation of good leadership. Mm. You've been really generous with your time, incredibly insightful. I am so happy that we got to sit down with you. Thank you very much for coming today.
Thanks.
And thank you guys.
And good luck in your negotiations with the mine people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, that was Valtteri Raakallio, a choreographer and arts director and just all-round fantastic human. How do we feel, Annelie?
It was quite amazing. Very different from the corporate guests
huge
we have had.
Yeah.
Huge difference. Mm-hmm. Also the way he sort of inhales the world or the how he senses the world is so different and amazing. What I want to highlight, one thing, is the survey after each process or project that they do and how they look at the data and compare it or analyze it through a lens of how well did the artists or the dancers feel? What were their level of well-being in a broad sense of the word? And I really thought that this is something that the corporate world should actually start doing, looking at the well-being not through the lens of physical and mental well-being on an individual basis, but actually looking at it broadly, how did the well-being of the people produce achieve their goals of their project that they were working on, and do this after each project.
I think there might be a tricky thing in that for most businesses, because I think what he was really clear about is that in his domain, nobody punches the clock. Mm. Like you're in it, you're all in, and you're really like, you have to you're in it for the art and for the sake of it. And I think most businesses and corporations probably don't have that same level of commitment, but I do think there's definitely something there about pride in the work, pride in the product, pride in the outcome altogether. It was a really important piece. Alexei, what's there for you?
How do I feel?
How do you feel? How do you feel?
I feel like dancing.
I want to say.
Don't lie.
Hips don't lie. Shakira.
No, okay. My takeaways kind of, well, it was very different.
Hmm.
I agree. At the emotional level, at the level of excitement, I think a lot of cool things came out of this. But on the other hand, the way Valtteri was talking about how they manage this creative process, what I picked up was actually there's a lot of these kind of very traditional techniques also applied, even though they don't kind of, they think they do something completely radically different maybe, but the way he described, you know, how they work on creating a joint vision for the production, kind of the kind of common understanding of culture in those groups that they work with, how they kind of analyze the performances based on videotaping that they do, and then communication is very important. You should be able to articulate what is this 5% that he was talking about that should be there in the performance. I think a lot of analysis goes in. So actually in the end, and he's also teaching a lot of this kind of traditional management approaches and leadership approaches to...
Yeah, and he also provides the shield. So he takes the criticism full brunt and he doesn't allow the participants. And as he said, he's the captain of the ship.
Yeah, and he didn't use the concept of psychological safety, but he was talking about
He was talking about psychological
like
safety.
Exactly, taking the blame and, you know, away from on himself and like to release pressure from the group. One thing that probably I regret we didn't push a bit more was this whether he thinks his way of leading these processes is in any way Finnish or not international. Because, well, as I understood, he was implying that things are kind of becoming more homogeneous internationally, and there's a general shift in the industry, and there's nothing specific about Finland. But on the other hand, he works mostly in Finland. Even his dream production is actually a Finnish mine. So
deep
I think
in the bowels.
There's actually something quite Finnish in this. But yeah, if we get another chance, I would definitely ask something more about this.
That's true. Yeah, we didn't. Well. FLT the musical coming soon. it'll be on the way. Yeah, it's true. I think it would have been better to follow up a bit on the Finnishness angle. Although, I think there was so much in what he said. I think the thing that I'm left with, I do think there's big parallels between the artistic world and general management processes. And I think, Anneli, you're right that there's a lot to learn from business in how he manages and leads. But the thing that I was left with was more about the sort of sensory spectrum. And I don't have an answer for this, but I'm now going to think about how does the work I do make me feel physically, which is a very odd consideration. I've never thought about it before, so.
Yeah.
But.
Well, I feel hungry.
Hungry for more knowledge, I'm sure. Okay, well, that's going to do us for this one. Thanks again to Valtteri, who was awesome. Thanks again to Bella behind the mic and the camera. Thanks again for everybody that's listening, and to Aalto for some equipment and a fabulous setting that speaks to us.
Fabulous ruins.
The fabulous ruins. Okay. And then to you, Anneli and Alexei. Thanks.
Thank you, Mark.